Oh, Bill, how funny. I didn't realize that link was still open. So if I'm going to repost this in the chat. They changed the link on us. It's so funny because I did the same thing. Copy. Yeah, let me paste it because it. Lucky I did that. Lucky I stayed. Did you see it there? I needed the passcode, so I wouldn't close this until you log and jump into that other space. Cool. All right, good seeing you. Did you hear that all?
Yes.
So somehow it's interesting. I can be in two Zoom meetings at the same time. I didn't know that was possible. Now we know. I mean, on the same computer. I've done it on my cell phone and
We're just missing,
Bill will
we're
be right
waiting.
here, obviously.
Yeah, we're waiting also on either Na or TJ. I'm hoping we'll join. Hi everyone, this is Na. I'm on. Oh, okay. Oh, that's iPhone. Okay,
Yay.
perfect. Just kidding.
All
We've
right.
established quorum.
Great. All right, then we'll get started. Introductions. I'm Chuck Adams, one of the co-chairs of the committee. Go ahead, Manuel.
Hi everyone, Manuel Vasquez. I'm co-chair of Committee Affairs.
Thomas.
Thomas Noble, government co-chair, they them pronouns.
Matt.
Matt Geldmaker, council member.
Na.
Hi everyone, Na Lee, council member.
I'm just going to go through everybody since everybody's here. Maria.
Maria Lacayo, HIV Health Services, DPH.
Dara.
Dara Geckler with Facenti Consulting.
Erin.
Hi everyone, my name is Erin Antunes. I'm the links program manager at DPH.
And let me see if I get this one. Lizette. That close?
That is correct. Hi, I'm Lizette. I am with HIV.
Thanks. Bill.
Hi, Bill Bloom, SFDPH, HIV Health Services.
And Mia.
Hi, everyone. My name is Mia Chen, and I'm an epidemiologist with HIV Surveillance, SFDPH. Nice to meet everyone.
Thank you, everybody.
Kara, council staff.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. And you have the biggest smile, yes. All right, so let's review the draft agenda.
Chuck, I don't know if other people are aware. The invite I had had a previous link. So maybe if there are other people who haven't joined yet, it may be due to that.
Okay.
It's but, funny, Bill. Our whole conversation, they could hear us. So when I was talking to you, I was actually in this meeting too. So they're all aware. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So does anybody have anything they want to change or move around on the agenda? If not, then we'll leave it like that and do it by consensus. And let's move on to the draft minutes from September 12th. Anybody see any changes that need to be made? If not, then we'll do that by consensus also. Now we're ready for announcements. Anybody have any announcements?
I have an announcement.
Oh, go ahead, Kira.
Announcement slash reminder, if you haven't filled out the meeting evaluation for last month's full council, please do so. Next week is the last week to do that. So yeah.
Cool. So is there any public comment? I don't see any public. So I guess we're moving on to cluster detection, and I'm not exactly sure who's leading that. Are you, Kira?
No, that is not me.
It's actually us.
Yeah, I know. I just thought she might know who was actually taking the lead on it. I don't have that info.
We are a three-headed hydra, four-headed hydra. Cool. So Mia is going to go first. Is that right, Mia?
Right. And Thomas, will you share the slide?
I can. Or... Let's see. Screen share.
Yeah.
Is that working?
Yeah.
Great. Go to presenter mode. Cool. All right. Let me know when you want me to advance, Mia.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, hi, good morning. Good afternoon, everyone. On behalf of SFDPH HIV Cluster Detection and Response Work Group, and I would like to first thank HCPC for this opportunity to present. And we will, you know, have four presenters today, including me. I'm Mia Chen, and as I just mentioned, I'm epidemiologist at Arches Branch. And also Lisa Duran, who is a CDC Direct Assistance Epidemiologist. And Aaron Antunes is our links manager, and also Thomas, who is our ETE manager. Next, please. Okay, and here is the outline for today's presentation. And first, I will briefly introduce public health surveillance and the Ending the HIV Epidemic initiative. And Dessert will provide an overview on the cluster detection and response. And then Aaron will talk about how SF responds to cluster by describing links navigation activities and the community testing events SF conducted in responding to clusters. Finally, Thomas will talk about the community's response on the CDR implementation and how SF do to reduce the potential risk and what SF has been working on in terms of the community engagement. Next slide, please. Next. Okay, so public health helps people and communities. And to understand public health problems and health department tracked illness and other health conditions. And this is called public health surveillance. And public health surveillance has been used for more than 100 years for a wide variety of conditions like foodborne disease, tuberculosis, cancer, COVID-19, and HIV. Next slide, please. And the information health department gather are used to monitor trends, describe disease burden, identify health disparities, detect outbreak, and monitor prevention and care outcome. Those data lead to public health actions to guide public health policy and prevention strategies with the goal to keep people healthy. Next slide, please. And public health data allows us to see the trends in HIV over time and helps us understand if interventions are working or not working. For the past decade, there have been exciting advancements on HIV testing, care, treatment, and prevention. SFDPH implemented programs to utilize those tools to, please click, test and treat people early and effectively to not only keep persons with HIV healthy, but to prevent further transmission. Click, please. Okay, and for the individuals who are at risk, we scale up PrEP services to prevent them from getting HIV. Next. And we also started to implement a new strategy, cluster detection. Those efforts led to a decrease in the yearly number of new HIV diagnoses in SF. However, the decrease trend has been impacted by COVID-19. The numbers of new diagnoses are stabilized since COVID pandemic, And for us to really reach the goal of getting to zero infection, we will need all the tools in our toolbox and to design programs to deliver those services to the populations in need. Click next. And the U.S. Ending the HIV Epidemic, or EHE, is a federal initiative launched in 2019. The funds selected state and local health departments to implement HIV prevention strategies. Next slide, please.
Okay.
EHE categorized, sorry, Thomas. Too far. Thank you. Okay. So EHE categorized the prevention activities into four pillars: diagnose, treat, prevent, and respond. And the fourth pillar, respond, which identifies where rapid transmission is occurring and where the service gaps might be. And these activities can inform and guide the other strategies to provide focused prevention and treatment services to people who need it most. So for today's presentation, we'll focus on the respond pillar, cluster detection and response in San Francisco. And next, we will have Lizette to provide an overview on what is cluster detection and response. Thomas, next slide, please.
Thank you, Mia. I'm going to talk to you about cluster detection and response, but before I begin, I want to remind you what clusters are. Sometimes when an infectious disease breaks out in a population, I apologize for my dog. It appears that the spread is random, with people throughout the population seemingly being infected randomly. However, other times, cases of infectious disease can occur in a group of people living, working, or visiting the same area. When this occurs, we call this disease a cluster. For example, clusters of swine flu influenza virus affect humans that are detected visiting state fairs during the summer. Click, please. Appearance of clusters indicate that something in the shared environment led to the transmission of the disease. To break this transmission pattern and to prevent the spread of diseases, disease detectives work to find out this common cause of transmission. Click, please. And sometimes this disease transmission is a very small overlap between the infected individuals. Click, please. So how do disease detectives detect clusters? Next slide, please. There are multiple ways to detect clusters. Often, healthcare providers or community members will notice an increase in the number of people with newly diagnosed HIV. An outbreak, for example, of HIV in Massachusetts was first detected by a provider at a local healthcare center who then notified the health departments. Partner services staff can also yield important information about the transmission of disease clusters. For example, the 2015 outbreak of injection drug users in Scott County, Indiana, was first detected through partner services, as well as an outbreak among people who inject drugs in Seattle. We can also routinely analyze HIV diagnosis data to identify clusters of an increased diagnosis among people who are living in a specific geographical area. This is usually a county or a city. This approach is often called time-space analysis. Click, please. Because it involves looking at a number of diagnoses in a given space and a period of time. HIV clusters in West Virginia, Philadelphia, North Carolina were detected through time-space clusters approach. This approach is particularly effective in areas with small populations or low rates of HIV and for detecting clusters among people who inject drugs. However, this method has some drawbacks. It may miss the increases in HIV, for example, among people who travel to meet partners or who do not live in the same geographical area. The fourth approach, the analysis of genetic data, allows us to detect networks of people experiencing rapid HIV transmission. This approach can be particularly helpful in more populated areas or areas with many HIV diagnoses. click, please. Large cluster in San Antonio was first detected using genetic analysis. Next slide, please. Now that we know a bit more about what clusters are and how they are detected, let's talk about cluster detection and response. Cluster detection and response is a way to use data to inform public health action. In this setting, clusters are a group of related HIV diagnoses. When an HIV cluster with many recent diagnoses is detected, this may indicate rapid transmission of HIV within a group of people in a specific location or specific social network. Cluster detection is important because clusters happen when our standard HIV treatment and prevention services aren't reaching the people who need them the most. Understanding where these gaps in services are happening presents opportunities to respond as quickly as possible to close these gaps by tailoring prevention services to meet the needs of the local community. It is important to note that not all clusters identified indicate recent and rapid transmission. Many clusters may only have two persons, and some may include cases diagnosed in a more distant past. As such, public health entities help develop criteria to prioritize clusters concerning of rapid and recent transmission. So why is this information valuable? As I mentioned, cluster detection allows us to provide tailored services to persons in a network experiencing rapid and recent HIV transmission, with the goal to improve health outcomes and to interrupt further transmission. Next slide, please. Before we continue, I do want to pause to relay a very important point. HIV genetic data cannot be used to determine directionality, and having genetically similar viruses does not indicate direct transmission between two people. This is due to the fact that some people in a network may not be diagnosed, not seeking care, or the provider did not order drug-resistant testing. Therefore, we do not know if transmission patterns look like this. Click, please. Or like this, click please. HIV genetic data only tells us the cases are related, but not any particular direction. Click please. Next slide, please. Now I would like to show you how cluster detection has been used to identify outbreaks in other jurisdictions. In an outbreak affecting people who inject drugs in northeastern Massachusetts, qualitative interviews with people who inject drugs, providers, and other stakeholders identifying important challenges in assessing HIV treatment and syringe service programs.
I think we lost Lisette. Give it a second. I think they're logging back in. Lizette, are you there? All right, we got a picture. Can't hear you at the moment.
Oh, can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay. Importantly, in this outbreak, 50 of 129 people with new HIV diagnosis were first identified as part of an outbreak through genetic analysis. And the genetic data were essential in understanding the outbreak was not limited to the northeastern part of the state. The qualitative information combined with the genetic data led to statewide expansion of syringe service programs from 9 syringe service programs to 34. Click, please. Different rate.
Coming back. Appreciate you. We lost you for a second there, Lizette. The last we heard was the 34 syringe programs.
Okay, excellent. So in response to cluster detection and response, just wanted to highlight that Methodist expanded their syringe service from 9 to 34, which was a great win for the state. So Gay and bisexual men in San Antonio, providers, community members, and CDC staff established the End Stigma and HIV Alliance. Their efforts led to multiple community-based efforts, including increased community-based testing, enhanced partner services to ensure HIV negative prep, and a letter writing campaign to provide.
All right, Lizette, the last thing we heard was letter writing campaign.
Okay, sorry about that. All right, so the letter writing campaign was to providers to have them increase routine HIV testing and given prescriptions for PrEP. And these efforts led to linkage to HIV care to reduce stigma from 13 days to just two. To entry to care from just 13 days to two. And also led to quadrupling of HIV testing and activities to reduce stigma. And I am done. Apologies for the technical issues.
You got through it. So Aaron's now going to take it from here about a little bit of local response. Go for it, Aaron.
Yes, okay. So my slides pertain to hearing about how San Francisco responds to clusters. So since 2017, SFDPH has been running analyses to identify groups of related diagnoses of HIV that meet our locally defined criteria for response. So as Lisette mentioned before, we look at diagnoses closely related in time, location, and their genetic sequences. And when we identify a group with related diagnoses, we determine who's not in care and refer those individuals to links navigation. Next slide, please. So what is links? Links stands for Linkage Integration, Navigation, and Comprehensive Services. We are a partner services and linkage to care program staffed by disease intervention specialists and navigators. We aim to reduce transmission and morbidity and mortality from STIs, including HIV. Our staff work at the health department to offer partner services, linkage to care, and partner services. We are sexual health specialists with the goals to ensure people receive non-stigmatizing treatment and sexual health care. And I just want to be thoughtful and just, you know, let you all know that I want to be thoughtful about the language that you might be hearing in the presentation. There's a world of language that we use in our DIS work that's separate from the language that we use outside of work when communicating. There's words like case or investigation or named that may not be people-centered, and we do our best not to use them when communicating with the community. Next slide, please. So links provides navigation services. This is one of the parts and components of our program. Where we're helping to find and connect people living with HIV who are out of care and help return them to care. These services include 3 months of intensive support with everything from appointment reminders, escorts, transportation. We offer a lot of different types of guidance and navigation regarding matchmaking to clinics or navigating benefits. Really the system navigation part of the job. We also have the staff for highly trained in motivational interviewing, health education, all with a harm reduction lens. And we have a whole variety and a network of resources that we access to help people address the barriers that they identify that have been keeping them out of care, including like food insecurity or lack of transportation to get to a clinic, housing. Some examples of that. Let's see, next slide, please. So links, how do we respond? Links has been providing navigation for people living with HIV for over 10 years. We have a history of training our navigators to provide navigation for people who are out of care. And we have protocols for confidentially outreaching to these people.
So when clusters are identified, or these groups of people with related diagnoses, we have a whole system already set in place. And so one thing I really did want to highlight today is that we have not, in our last couple of years of doing cluster work, LINCS has not done any outreach to anyone who's already in HIV care. So part of our investigation is checking to see who's already in care, and people who are, we are not reaching out to. It's really, we've focused our approach in trying to reach out to people who appear to be not engaged in HIV primary care. Something else unique about cluster work is that navigators have offered a small number of people living with HIV a cluster interview. That's something where we ask them about prevention and care experience. And we ask open-ended questions to try to get their perspective on what can be done to stop HIV transmission. And some of these interviews among people in clusters have led to focused community outreach service opportunities and testing events. So before I tell you about those events, I did want to highlight some outcomes. Next slide. Some outcomes of our cluster work. Next slide, please. Those, okay, right there. So from 2020 to 2022, of the 90 San Francisco residents that were in over 10 clusters that were referred to our program, over 50% of those people were either successfully linked to care or confirmed to not be in care already through our investigative work. Also, I wanted to highlight, additionally, 30 people were found to be living out of jurisdiction, and they were referred directly to DIS or navigators in other counties for follow-up. Next slide, please. So as I mentioned before, cluster interviews are a unique part of our work and involve asking a series of open-ended questions about experiences with STI prevention, harm reduction, and health resources. So some cluster interviews helped us identify a service gap in which community members identified that people in their community were not accessing prevention and testing. And they also helped identify locations that they believed would benefit from having health resources, including testing, brought in. So CHEP coordinated a collaboration with a group of providers, including SFCH, the San Francisco Community Health Center, the street medicine team, and health workers from CHEP and LINCS. We had a successful integrated approach to provide a bunch of services, including testing, naloxone, fentanyl test strips, linkages and referrals to treatment and other health needs. And the team that had these events, they had two community-driven approaches. One was door-to-door testing, where literally people went door-to-door at these locations trying to see if people were interested in any of these services, including offering confidential testing. And then there was also like a central area where they were doing these pop-up testing clinics. So there were three very well-received and attended events. So over 120 people were engaged during these events, and about 40 of them received STI and HIV testing. We had several people who were diagnosed with STIs and treated immediately same day at the events. And at one of the three events, there was one new diagnosis of HIV. That person was immediately escorted over to City Clinic to be rapided and engaged in care. That's all for my part. Thanks.
Great. Thanks, Erin. So I've got about four or five slides just with regards to what's going on with community engagement around this particular intervention. So just for before kind of starting that conversation, though, I think there's been visibility around PACHA kind of put out a document with concerns with regards to privacy and data, with people's information being shared in a way that they may not have consented to. And all things that are very valid, but we want to make sure that we're kind of calling those out and putting those out in a way that is transparent and that we're engaging in the community with those concerns. Specifically, these concerns, California actually has things in place to actually reduce that risk significantly. And Pacha's concerns were more national energy that was kind of being put out there. So these are some of those things that we in San Francisco specifically have in place in order to protect people's PHI and name information and standard components with regards to health and safety codes, how data is basically not shared with other entities, and that it is encrypted and stored securely and can only be accessed by a small number of people who are working in public health. This is a reference to the health and safety code that prohibits disclosure of HIV data to any third party unless authorized by law enforcement. And this is rarely ever activated with regards to law enforcement actually making that happen. Then the other piece is that there's a community advisory board that we are working with for the state of California, trying to interact with people to kind of, Aaron mentioned it earlier with regards to being sensitive to language and things along those lines. So not using words like molecular or surveillance or outbreak or making sure that we're using language that is more people first. The word cluster can even be relatively confusing. I know when I think of it, I think of hundreds of people kind of engaged in a cluster versus it can be as, you know, a small number of people as well. So just hearing that language and not all being on the same page and having the same definition is, can make the conversations challenging. So the advisory board is basically also in the same realm with regards to making sure that this particular intervention is making sure that it's focusing on people and driving resources to communities that may traditionally be underserved and missed by our current efforts that we are doing here, particularly in San Francisco. Kings County and Washington had a similar process with regards to engaging community and kind of having similar conversations around what they wanted to see in place, making sure the community was kind of informed and well-versed with regards to what cluster detection and response was. And we are trying to follow some of their mentoring with regards to putting things into place and having this conversation. And I think this is the last slide, yeah. So just some things. So DARPin, I don't know if folks remember or who might have been around. We basically presented this to the council in 2019, letting folks kind of know that this tool was in existence. Obviously, COVID hit, and then things got derailed in a significant way. We also are just being conscious of language, participating with the California Advisory Panel, working with the Ending the Epidemics committees that we currently have in place and presenting this information and sharing out what the resource or what the intervention is, and then doing this particular presentation for the Planning Council and then looking to the future. And that is it. So I'm gonna stop screen sharing and then take questions. All right, questions? Could not have been that thorough, right? Maybe it was.
I have a quick question. Is your cluster detection protocol something that you can share with Marin County? Because I know CDPH had asked us about a protocol and we don't have a formal one in place. So I'm wondering what yours looks like and if it's something that our county can adopt.
We're happy to share whatever we've got. I just feel like I really need to kind of acknowledge Lizette and Mia and Aaron's kind of work in this. So specifically kind of the data crunching that goes on behind the scenes is pretty amazing. And I feel kind of privileged to be able to have that resource within San Francisco. So I'm a little bit nervous that you might not have that same infrastructure behind you to make stuff happen, but we are more than happy to partner with you anytime, Nah.
Yeah, we probably don't.
I'm like, how do I say this nicely?
existing cases that we investigate for new HIV diagnoses. So that's why we don't have a cluster detection protocol. But, you know, CDPH had asked us, so we're like, do we need to put something together? Although, yeah, we have our PHIs, and, you know, they investigate thoroughly, so they know if the cases are related, but we don't have anything formal. Yeah.
Yeah, fair enough.
Have you been pulled into any? I know we were pulled into two different clusters that were actually statewide clusters through CDPH. So I don't know. There's also what the state does to pull us in. So it's curious. I don't know what they were asking specifically for you from Marin, but definitely with San Mateo, we've been pulled into a couple different clusters.
Yeah, we basically told them that we would just follow the state on what they want us to do if there is a cluster detection that's in our county. Yeah.
Mia, yes. You want to respond to that? Yeah, go for it.
Yeah. The cluster detection and response tool specifically for the HIV sequences analysis is only, you know, available to the state, San Francisco, and LA County. So that's why, and state, especially they have the data for the statewide data. So locally, like San Francisco, we don't have the data that from the people who never receiving care in San Francisco. So our ability to really detect the cluster is actually it kind of more limited compared to the state. So state has their routine work processes each month to detect a statewide cluster. And so if they see any cluster of concern, not every cluster they've been detected is of concern, but if they detect it and they will identify the jurisdiction that has the persons involved, and, you know, we'll have the conference call and to identify any prevention strategies that each jurisdiction might be able to have and to implement within their own county.
Thanks, Mia. Matt, did that kind of get at your question or your comment?
Yeah, no, she just kind of reiterated the same. The state does all the genetic sequencing and they'll pull you in. It was just odd. I wasn't sure not what you were saying. The state was asking you for some but
One of their reports, they asked for like an HIV investigation protocol, field test.
So just
And then they also asked about cluster detection, and we just responded that we don't have something. So I was curious if something we could put together, but maybe it's a little bit too complex for our small county.
Or maybe they're looking for something relatively simple, based on kind of what you already do with regards to partner services. That's what you're thinking, Matt? Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. Bill, I see your hand.
Yeah, just want to thank you guys for presenting and talking about the guardrails that are around this. I do think it's also just important to also highlight that California is a state where transmission of HIV is prosecutable. It is in the health and safety code. So as we go forward, particularly within DPH and our community partners, it's important to recognize that people could be at risk at some point if directionality can be determined. So we need to be mindful of stewards of this potentially powerful technology. If at some point it is able to determine direction, that we make sure that we don't have people, the law doesn't distinguish between knowingly transmitting and unknowingly transmitting it. So just to keep an eye out for that.
Thanks, Bill. Yeah, we're in an odd spot. Like, we don't use it a lot, but we don't want to hide it. Right. So that's part of these conversations. We don't want to freak people out, but we also want to be really conscious with regards to the people's concerns and addressing those. And what you're saying is like the worm turned in the wrong direction. It could not be good. It is interesting. Go ahead.
This is all great. And we need to move on to the next presentation. Well, we'll get into the next one. So Dara, with the consulting firm, we're going to start in on the blueprint implementation.
Sure. Let me get my screen shared here.
Okay.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm Dara Geckler. I'm with Facenti Consulting, and The state of California has contracted with Facenti Consulting to provide technical assistance to the California counties around their blueprint development. So I'm here in that capacity. Bill and I wanted to talk to you a little bit today about what we think the council's role in the blueprint development could be. And so I'm actually going to turn it over to Bill just to give us a little bit of context and background.
Sure. Thanks, Darren. Good afternoon to everybody. Hope everyone is doing well. So you all may recall that both I, Thomas, and Leroy have presented to you in the past at the Planning Council about what is currently called the Blueprint, which is a part of the California State Office of AIDS implementation plan. The reasons that we're sharing it with you is because it meets the requirements for the Ryan White Part A, what used to be called the Integrated or Joint Plan before, when it was HIV prevention and care. And before that, for those of you around for a long time, it was just the plan. So it's looking forward about how the Planning Council and the grantee, in this case, San Francisco Department of Public Health, work together to make sure we have a plan about how we prioritize and allocate funds, how we look at what's important in terms of reducing the epidemic and providing services that they need. So the original document had the companion document, which we shared with the Planning Council, which was called the Blueprint, which allows for customization, which Dara is gonna get into. I jokingly refer to this as a three-fer or the four-fer kind of document because it meets the needs for Ryan White Part A for the joint plan or the integrated plan. It also meets our local participation with the state EHE planning. And it meets our local need for EHE planning. And then finally, it's an opportunity to kind of address or invite the Planning Council to have kind of greater awareness and partnership in terms of doing syndemics work, which is in addition to HIV prevention and care, looking at STI, mental health, housing, and hepatitis C. So as I mentioned before, really the goal is the Planning Council's input and partnership with this. And as you know, as you can hear, it's got a lot of different parts. So there's some specific parts that we'll definitely be looking for your input as well as your concurrence that this makes sense and this gives us the data we want and the directions we want to move in. So back to you, Dara, unless there's a question on this.
You're on mute, Dara.
That's better. Okay. So what we're hoping to accomplish today is by the end of the presentation to get your input on sort of the boundaries and structure of San Francisco's blueprint and consensus on how the HCPC will be involved and some clear next steps for your involvement. And so I just wanted to back up a little bit to the big picture and why we're doing this, apart from the reasons that it's a three-fer or four-fer and meeting different requirements. San Francisco, I think, has been moving towards a syndemic approach for a really long time. I actually did not know the origin of the term syndemic, so I looked it up and discovered that it's a blend of the words synergy and demic. So synergy of the population. There's so much overlap in HIV, hepatitis C, and STIs in terms of who is affected in San Francisco that it doesn't really make sense, as you know, for services to be siloed. That's why part of the reason that the Centers of Excellence came to be and the reason that the health access points, the HAPs, came to be is to try to really take much more of a whole person approach and having integrated services. And so San Francisco, I think, has been a real leader in that respect. And now the state of California has really put forward very strongly that they feel like the strategic path towards ending this endemic is really built, is really relies on us addressing many of the social determinants of health, those root causes that are really underlying the continued transmission that we're seeing and the disparities in health outcomes. And so that's really the bottom line for why to have the blueprint is it's a way for us to look at the activities that are happening in San Francisco through the lens of the social determinants of health, and also through this syndemic lens that is not just exclusive to HIV. It's a way of us being able to see how all of the work together is addressing the root causes and reaching the whole person. So there's a couple of different ways that we could approach this, and this is part of what I want to get your feedback on. So now the state has their strategic plan, and San Francisco is going to develop its blueprint. We're trying to figure out how to actually approach it for San Francisco. So there's the organizing principle for the state's plan is around these social determinants of health. So racial equity, housing first, health access for all, mental health and substance use, economic justice, and stigma. And so our San Francisco's task is to really identify what's being done in each of these areas and to figure out where there are gaps or needs, see if there's a way that those gaps or needs can be addressed with the resources that are available. And I want to emphasize that it doesn't always mean that it has to be, that the responsibility has to fall on SFDPH and the HIV-funded community-based organizations doing this. This is really thinking through what kinds of partnerships might we build or connect so that we can address these issues more holistically. So the question on the floor is really that not, I mean, there's so much happening in San Francisco around HIV, hepatitis C, and STIs, and much of that will be relevant to addressing the social determinants of health, but not all of it. So there's many things happening in the areas of diagnose, treat, prevent, and respond that are not necessarily directly related to the social determinants. So since this blueprint is sort of serving as the integrated plan, I think my question for the group is, what is your thinking about the boundaries of this blueprint? Should it really just focus on the pieces of the work that are happening to address social determinants? Or is it more comprehensive, and does it also include general activities that may not be directly addressing the social determinants? So we're going to talk about that in a minute. And I want to be clear that this is it, whatever the process and boundaries we set on this, I think it's largely going to be an exercise in really codifying all of the amazing work that San Francisco is already doing. It's not to say there's not more to do or there isn't improvement to be had, but like I said, it's an opportunity to look at the work through a different lens and think about the ways that we can shift or leverage existing resources to do things differently so that we can have a bigger impact. And I point that out because, as often happens, there's sort of this, you know, requirement for the plan. There's no money that comes with this, right? This is like a planning process. It doesn't come with funding other than the base funding that you all already get. So the task here, I think, is to look for how we can do better with what we have. So given that, I'm interested to hear what questions folks have, if you have thoughts about how we should approach what goes in the blueprint, and any thoughts about the council's role, which we're thinking might involve identifying some gaps and thinking through where we could do a better job. So I will stop talking and take some questions or comments.
So I'm confused.
Okay.
Because usually this meeting is about, we're just reviewing presentations that are going to the full council meeting. So I'm confused what we're doing here today with this.
Bill, do you want to address that?
Sure. Hi, Matt. At a previous meeting, Mark had suggested and the Planning Council voted that this committee would serve as a home committee, actually to do this work, hear presentations, partner with Vicente and DPH to bring it back to the full council.
Okay. I must have
so you guys got a new role. I think that was when we did the concurrence, I think around August, September, a bit of back. Okay. But yes, you guys get this, unless you guys want to start a rebellion, it's starting here.
No, where I just was lost.
No worries. Okay.
Does anyone have any thoughts to start us?
I just mentioned in the chat box, like, I think option one is really cool. Daria, as you pointed out, noting all that SF has done, that's a lot. I feel like that in itself. And I think having to be able to build all that together to show like a continuum, that would be quite an undertaking. To add the option two, oh my gosh, I can't even imagine. That seems very monumental, like to add all the practice and health and stuff like that. You know, I think adding that, I think it would be great ambition, but I think just someone who has written plans before, I think option one would be much more achievable. That's my opinion.
Thanks, Manuel.
Go ahead, Bill.
Just wanted to clarify, this is not a pro or a con, but in case people didn't catch it, the option two, what it has before those are the four pillars of EHE. So just so people will be clear, that wasn't an invention from Vicente. So if you go for option two, you're talking about then doing the relational work to fit into the EHE framework.
Other thoughts or opinions? I thought I saw Thomas maybe.
Oh, how funny, Dara, like maybe the 20-year relationship is. So Manuel, I appreciate your what's the word I want to say, shepherding of time and energy
opinion.
Well, not so much. You were looking out for Dara and whoever was going to have to take on this instrumental task. So your nurturing is, I think, the closest word I can think of at the moment. But I do, like, we are going to have to respond to various things in those categories. So that's my thought. Like, maybe there's something in between where we use some of those buckets. We don't try to be completely comprehensive. But it would really be kind of nice to know specifically, like, what are we doing around diagnosis and specifically with a racially informed lens, and what are we doing in that particular field, and then housing first and things along those lines. So any kind of crosswork, or at least in our prevention world, a lot of it is about intersectionalities these days and people's identities. So that's kind of my, like, outside of the realistic world, which I think was where Manuel is trying to take us, but more in the, like, we're really in a spot in our prevention strategies where we have to start looking at things from multiple levels and multiple lenses, and which is really making the work hard, to tell you the truth. So that intersectionality is a challenge, but it also kind of forces us to work with partners like you around housing, right?
Thanks, Thomas.
So I don't think that's helpful at all, Dara. It was just a little bit of a ramble, but yeah.
No, I think what you were saying is that there's maybe a happy medium where, like, for example, under diagnose, we don't list every single location where testing is being done and who it's for and what hours and all of that, but maybe it's more like we have community-based testing and we have routine opt-out testing in healthcare settings. And for hepatitis C, we have this, and STIs, we have this, like more of a big picture of the types of activities that we do and why we do them. I think that's kind of what you're getting at. Is that right?
Very much so. And I think maybe even throwing a little bit of data in there, because I'm starting to, like, okay, where are our 150 people who were new infections last year? Where were they diagnosed? So we know San Francisco General has a role in that. The jails have a role in that. And so... having that as part of our lens will make us really effective on where do we need to plan. And so, yeah.
And we might be surprised as we start to get into this as to how much is addressing social determinants. Like when I was thinking through this presentation, I was like, well, what about testing? You know, that's the key thing under diagnose, but what would that look like as connected to the social determinants? Well, the HAPs are very much connected to racial equity, right? And so they are offering testing. There's also the Take Me Home testing, which is about access to care. There's testing that street medicine does, which is access to care for people experiencing homelessness. So there's so much that really is connected to these social determinants. We might find out that's even an overwhelming task to pull all that together.
Awesome.
So any last comments? And if not, I can share what we're thinking for next steps. Yes, okay. So this is what we're thinking for next steps. The idea is that SFDPH and Vicente Consulting will work together to essentially fill out that blueprint template with all the various activities. And then we will get that out to the council in advance of the November meeting. And then one main agenda item at the November meeting could be to really look at the blueprint and get input from the council on what could be done better or differently in terms of syndemic activities. It could be really a great way for the council to go even bigger and give their thoughts, not just about HIV, but how, you know, hepatitis C and STIs can be addressed in that context. And then we'll get the input and the ideas and we'll figure out how to bring it into the blueprint and get that done. Any thoughts or comments on next steps?
That seems like a really good, the next steps seem really well organized because November is always kind of a slow meeting anyway. So that's a great time. That's a great time to be doing this. Yeah.
Excellent. Anything I missed, Bill?
No. To stress at the end, we are looking for concurrence from the Planning Council. Not that we expect you all to have finalized opinions about the syndemics, but really, it's about situational awareness and to be our thinking partners and strategizing about how we can extend it and incorporate and more fully integrate.
What was the one thing that I saw about identifying gaps? Is that something else that you would want follow up?
Yeah, I think that'll be the main sort of task at the November meeting for folks to have looked at the draft blueprint ahead of time. And we'll have a structured discussion about where we think there are gaps. Like we might find that, I don't know, we're not doing enough around housing first, or we're not doing enough, or maybe our efforts need to shift in a different direction, for example, around housing first. So that'll be for the council to give their thoughts and figure out what we should incorporate in the blueprint that's missing.
All right, well, thank you, Dara, for doing this.
Yeah, thank you so much.
We're looking forward to what you send back and then we'll take it for next month.
Sounds great. Thank you, Chuck. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye. Yeah, thank you. Good seeing you.
All right, next up is Matt with the San Mateo County Annual Update. Unmute.
Am I sharing or I can share?
Go ahead, Matt.
I plan on making edits while I'm going since I just, like I said, I caught one typo already in the thing. And I just saw all this data for the first time just this morning. I had sent last year's because it's basically the same format every year. So I've never shared my screen in Zoom. We always use Teams, so I don't know exactly what I'm doing.
Bottom, there you go.
Does that work?
Yay.
Yes.
Okay. So I usually I create this with our FDs in Publisher, and then I save it as a PDF. And I have it in Publisher right now because I immediately caught some typos, and this way I can edit as we're going along.
Did anybody else's sound get weird?
Can you hear me?
It's a little choppy, yeah.
Can you hear me?
Now you're better, Matt. Yeah, I don't know what you did different.
I didn't move, so I don't know. I'll just try to speak louder.
Can you magnify as well?
And I can't see any of you while I'm sharing, so you'll have to just interrupt me and stop me.
Matt, can you make this visual bigger? Can you magnify? There you go.
You'll have to look. Oh, that's way too big. I can't even. this is the problem. I'm at home on my laptop, so it makes it hard for me to. I'll just have to scroll. Okay, so this is, like I said, it's the same format that we do every year. So the first page is always the current living HIV cases in San Mateo County compared to the state of California. So this is the San Mateo, and this is all from EHARS. So it's the data through the state. For the county, it's through December 31st of 2022. For the state of California, it's December 31st, 2021, because California is always a little bit behind in reporting out the most current data. So it kind of, it's the same. We're quite similar in a lot of ways to the state. So gender, male, female, trans data is all very similar. Race, ethnicity is very similar. We do have a much larger Latina, Latino, Latinx population with living with HIV than San Francisco's. And you'll see when I get down to the fourth slide, which is the new diagnoses. But I just kind of run through a lot of this data with race, ethnicity, the current age. So as you can see, the majority are in the 50 to 59, and then the highest percentage is 60 plus, which we're a little bit larger than the rest of the state. The exposure categories, very high in MSM. We're always very low in IDU, and you'll even see that within our newly diagnosed population as well. We always have a slightly higher heterosexual contact. And this is a lot of self-report, even though we're doing a lot. My HIV surveillance person is going in and doing chart reviews on new diagnosis, because we also used to have a much higher unknown risk. And we've gotten that down. And you'll see even in the newly diagnosed, we got that down to 0% now. So we've gotten some type of diagnosis. A lot of times, though, we have the report coming in as heterosexual contact. The next two slides are actually, we used to only do this first slide. A lot of people aren't familiar with San Mateo County, what it looks like. So this is San Francisco up here, and then Santa Clara kind of goes on this diagonal down here. A lot of this is very, very sparsely populated areas, kind of where you see on the coast and in different places. This is more industrial. So this one just shows by rates, so not by cases. So it's number of cases per 10,000 population. This is my EPI data, and it's showing that actually it's very interesting that COLMA 94014 is a large high rate, but COLMA, as many of you may not know, is home to many of the Bay Area's cemeteries. So there is not a large living population in the COLMA area. It's a lot of cemeteries. So a few number of cases, that's where the rates can kind of make it look like, oh my goodness, there's a lot going on in COLMA, when there actually isn't. But we do have down here in the 94063 zip code is one of our larger areas too, and then Daly City and South City. The next one that is new this year that we added, it's kind of putting the city names there because a lot of people don't know zip codes. So again, Daly City is right here. This is the COLMA area in South City. Pacifica, then San Mateo. And this is the Redwood City. It's also referred to as North Fair Oaks area, very heavily populated with immigrant Latino population. And that's where we do have a large concentration of HIV. Many, many, many years ago, down here in East Palo Alto, Palo Alto is Santa Clara County, East Palo Alto is San Mateo County. That back in the early stages of the epidemic would have been the very dark blue. And this has been the changing population, gentrification of East Palo Alto has drastically changed the population and the makeup of that area. But that just gives a visual representation. Here is the data on the newly reported cases. We did have an uptick in cases. We've been seeing a decline throughout COVID naturally. I think a lot of people were not testing and not getting screened for even STIs. We are we're starting to do a lot bigger, deeper dive into these newly diagnosed cases to get a better understanding. The majority of them are actually newly immigrant population that are not even necessarily brand newly diagnosed infections. They may be newly diagnosed infections in the United States, but these are oftentimes either people coming to our country that have been diagnosed in their country of origin, or they hadn't been diagnosed, and then we've gotten quite a significant number of late testers, people who are testing positive as well as coming in with an AIDS diagnosis because they have not tested in the past in their country's origin. So we're doing a lot deeper dive into these numbers, the diagnosed cases. Again, it's heavily, because of the small number, one case is about 2 percentage points. So if you see like 7%, that's really only like 4 cases. So it's not a huge number, but it's heavily male, as you can see here. The vast majority of diagnoses are between 20 and 39 years old, which I think was similar to San Francisco's epi presentation that we received from Sharon. Here, the vast majority, which I mentioned last month when Sharon was presenting, we have in San Mateo have always been much higher with the Latinx population with new diagnoses. We did see kind of this weird blip here with Asian population, but again, because the numbers aren't great, it's hard to say, you know, what's really going on. And I actually spoke with my HIV surveillance person today, and he was saying that and this kind of ties into back to the maps. I was curious because I saw here we have Asian, but then on the living HIV cases that come out of EHARS, we have Pacific Islander Native Hawaiian. We have a very large Filipino population in the Daly City, South San Francisco area. And I said, you know, where are most of our newer infections in the Asian population really Filipino? And I said, is that Pacific Islander or Asian? And it's interesting, it's the way that the CDC sets up the definitions. The race is Asian and then ethnicity is Pacific Islander. So when we get down to this level, it's just being lumped into Asian, which I found interesting. Again, the vast majority, male-to-male sexual contact, very low injection drug use. Again, this higher heterosexual contact, male-to-male sexual contact and injection drug use. And I was very happy that we were finally able to get this down to zero to really be able to better identify what are the exposure categories for our newly infected. So that's the epi data that I always do. Then I go into kind of just some highlights, some key points. So I always talk about if we had an increase or decrease in the Part A funding. We did have an increase last year of $9,084. $9,000 of that we just allocated directly to the food bank home delivered meals service category. And then I always like to kind of look at historically. So going back to 2011, 2012 through the most recent year, we still have this pretty significant decrease of $600,000 that we experienced over that time period. So even though we've had an increase over the past couple of years, we still are much lower than we were 12 years ago. And prices have obviously gone up in the past 12 years. So it's kind of like a wash. This would be a larger kind of real-time decrease. We see an increase in new clients that seek Ryan White and Hopla funded services. So during that fiscal year of 2022-2023, we had a total of 604 clients receiving Ryan White funded and or Hopla funded services. Of those 604, 71 were new clients to receiving any services in our county. That doesn't mean they were newly diagnosed. It means that they could have moved into our county. Maybe they were already HIV positive, they lost insurance, whatever. So they did access some type of service within our county. And we had four deaths during that time period. Edison Clinic, which is our HIV clinic in San Mateo, they continue to focus vaccinating client population both for COVID and Mpox. We are doing the new COVID, they're not even called booster, and that's why I need to rework this. They're not calling the brand new variant COVID-19 vaccination a booster. I forget what the official title is of it. So I'll change that wording. We are also the first clinic in San Mateo to do the MPX vaccine to high-risk patients. We're still doing outreach efforts to make sure that all of the HIV clients are getting vaccinated at our clinic. We're also doing outreach to patients who are identified through our STI surveillance. So anybody who is reported to us with an STI, we're also talking to them about Mpox vaccination. During San Mateo Pride, which was June 11th, we collaborated with CDPH. Vicente Consulting worked with us too, because they were contracted by CDPH to do Mpox vaccines at different Pride events. So we also then, our STI HIV outreach team provided STI and HIV testing at the Pride event as well. We receive our HIV prevention funding, which is PS181802 through California Department of Public Health. We've received the same amount since 2019, which is just under $200,000, so it's not a whole lot of money at all. We use mostly county funds to cover the cost of our HIV prevention activities, which include the targeted HIV testing, targeted outreach, PrEP linkage to and retention and care and syringe exchange services. We offer PrEP services at the Edison Clinic, which is again the main HIV or the only HIV clinic, and our STI clinic, which I need to change right here. Referrals come from other providers, from the team that is doing outreach, from our, and then just from the patient referrals, self-referrals to get connected with PrEP. This is our website for our PrEP protocols. We're also our staff, our HIV prevention staff are also PrEP app enrollment workers, and we work with the state for PrEP app to get people connected with access if they are having problems paying for the medications. We also started receiving this back in 2019, and then it kind of got all delayed because of COVID, but extra funding from CDPH for enhanced STI and HCV screening activities. So we collaborate with our correctional health partners to provide routine testing for chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, HCV, and HIV within the two county jail facilities. And then we also partner with our street and field medicine team that goes out and works with the unhoused, and so that we can increase testing for those same infections that also we fund in the jails. So a lot of kind of cross collaboration with the other public health programs. This is a slide about my HIV community board. It's been a struggle getting everything started back up since COVID. We lost two of our full-time members last year. One moved out of the county and the other is having extreme health issues. We're hopeful that she'll be able to return, but it's made up of five members right now. Most of them are HIV positive consumers. community members. We usually meet four times a year. We had our first in-person meeting since the pandemic to do the prioritization back in June. And then we have a website with all the minutes and agendas and presentations. So this is the general demographic makeup. Three females, two male. The community board member who is out with health issues was our board chair for many years. And she's a trans woman of color, and we miss her input greatly. This is the race ethnicity makeup. We always struggled, given our high numbers of Latino clients, as well as people living with HIV. We've always struggled with trying to get input and joining of the community board. We've changed our dates, we change our times, because a lot of our clients are doing some type of work, so it's hard for them to come during the daytime, so we have the meetings in the evening. We've changed a lot of things, trying to figure out what's the best way. And then, as you can see, the vast majority are consumers of services, with only one being non-consumer. The last two slides, so the prioritization process, like I mentioned, we had it in our in-person meeting on June 21st. I did a lot of presentation of service utilization, a lot of the same kind of information that we receive here in San Francisco when we're in doing our stuff. The previous priority was from last year, so there was a change. They kind of flipped around, dropped oral health, surprisingly, down to the lower prioritization. There was just a lot of discussions about how mental health, I think a lot of this came out of COVID, where just mental health really impacted a lot of people, and they saw the importance of mental health services. This is where, again, early intervention services, I know on our prioritization that we did with the San Francisco group, that is utilized around vouchers to pay for, I think, genotyping, phenotyping, whereas that is not what our early intervention services are. Our early intervention services are linkage and to care and retention and care. So doing a lot of work with people who are newly diagnosed, getting them connected to care, as well as people that have fallen out of care to try to link them back into care. And that was core services, support services. There was some kind of flipping around of things. Medical transportation dropped down, and just kind of, it was like flipping between the top two and flipping between the bottom two. And then I always like to look just kind of historically at kind of where we, the amount of funding that we have put into the different service categories. So as you can tell, outpatient ambulatory health services has decreased significantly. If you go back even further, I can't have all the columns in here. We used to put over $1 million into this, but with the Affordable Care Act, you know, we're not needing as much because most people are covered under some type of benefits. Oral health, we had decreased back then as well. Medical case management, we continue to kind of increase to make sure that we're fully funding the social worker staff and the medical case managers who are assisting all of the clients in the clinic. Mental health services has been about the same. And the early intervention services, we had to pick up kind of the full position couple of years ago. And then under housing, or under the support services, this housing, again, we've kept this lower just because Ryan White with housing is very strict about what housing services can be paid for. The food bank home delivered meals is what we've greatly increased to really keep that community-based organization in their ability to provide services to the community. This was just funding, and I can actually end up taking this out. During COVID was some additional Ryan White funding that came to us because of COVID, and it was only a one-year thing. And we had given that into the food bank's home-delivered meals, so we tried to then just kind of adjust that into their ongoing Part A. Medical transportation has remained the same for quite a few years. We fully fund that with Ryan White Part B from the state. And then the emergency financial assistance, we've kind of steadily increased because that can be utilized for a lot of things, not just rent, but utilities and other things as well. It's a lot more flexible than the Ryan White Housing Services. So I'm going to stop sharing now. If I don't, oh, there. Okay. So that's the San Mateo annual presentation. Again, I couldn't see any of you, so I don't know if you had any questions. Nobody stopped me.
No, I didn't see any hands go up, but thank you for doing that.
I think Thomas does right now.
Huh?
But that's, oh, there Thomas. He is, right there. Okay, Thomas.
Oh, Maria, you put in updated COVID-19. I saw something in the chat. So Thomas, you have a question? Oh, sorry, I couldn't even see a hand. I'm like, what? How do you know Thomas has a question? He's not saying anything. Does Thomas have a question?
I don't know.
I think his voice or the audio is not working. Yeah, there, we can hear you now.
Matt, how do you do it all?
Do what all?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
So that's a lot happening with such a small team.
So we benefit from, I always say this, we're like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. We're not so big like San Francisco. With the higher morbidity, we have lower morbidity, obviously, in HIV. We have lower morbidity in STIs. We have lower morbidity in HCV. And we're not as big as San Francisco, where it can be overwhelming. And we're not as tiny as some of the smaller jurisdictions where they don't get any funding. And you have like one or two people trying to do everything. So we have greatly benefited from the programs being under me because, not because of me, but because I'm able to do what's called blended funding. And the state loves me because of our braided funding, blended funding. I sometimes call it the shell game because I'm getting funding from all different places. It's not mutually exclusive, meaning I may be able to do the same type of service with maybe two or three different types of funding, and they're on different cycles. So I can move stuff around. I can move people to be funded by different things throughout the year. I have one contract person who really is like my right-hand person, who she has to stay on top of everything. So underneath me, and I have TB as well. So underneath me, I have, and we just moved MPOX as well as all HCV is now moved over to us. So we're trying to clean up. For years, there was no follow through with, so the way hepatitis C gets reported, it comes into CalReady and you're either getting an antibody report. And most of the times you're just getting an antibody report, which really is meaningless because you don't know if the person still has HCV or if they cleared it or what's going on. So you need to have that RNA report. And thank God now under the state of California, even undetectable or negative RNA reports are reportable through CalReady. So we're able to then put together what is truly a case that we need to work with to try to link to treatment. Or is it somebody that was exposed to Hep C, but cleared it and they have no virus? So we can close it as not a case. And that way we're getting better data as to what truly the hepatitis C burden is in our jurisdiction, which we have not been able to do because that wasn't being done. So that has come over to my team as well. Which makes sense too, just with everything that we just had in the prior discussions, how Hep C, STIs, and HIV are all just intricately linked. And oftentimes we're doing, you know, our case investigations and contacting somebody and talking to them, we don't want multiple people talking to the same person, because I always look at it as a customer service piece. Even though these are the residents who may test positive for an infection are not coming to us for anything, we're going to them and contacting them. So we need to make it as user friendly and as culturally appropriate and as least intrusive as possible, and try to communicate our desire, not just for their health and safety, but for their partners' health and safety, their community's health and safety. I think it's public health is really having to struggle with that coming out of COVID because of how people weren't aware of what public health was, and the power that kind of came behind public health and the knowledge that we're able to get information. And so now people are less trustful of that. And when you're already dealing with populations that are marginalized or treated less than by government entities, society, whatever, you're having to really work within that. I just rambled on.
All right. Well, thank you for your report. And that's going to be the end of our agenda for today. And so the next meeting is going to be November 14th, 3 to 4 p.m. And thank you, Kira, for doing all this. And thank you, everybody, for showing up. So have a great rest of your afternoon.
Thanks, everyone.
Take care, everybody. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.